Hey everyone, Brian from All They Rock Off here, and today's podcast episode is with Brent Cooper, who is the executive director for the Green Beret Foundation. The Green Beret Foundation and GORUCK have had ties, I mean, as far back as I can remember, back to my first event in 2011. There was a portion of the entry from that first challenge that was donated to the Green Beret Foundation, so that's how I found out about them. And it's been interesting to see GORUCK's relationship with them over the years. In this episode, we talk about Brent's history, how he got involved with the Green Beret Foundation, his first GORUCK event, and all that other good stuff. It's pretty funny. Brent and I actually lived within a couple miles of each other for years, and it wasn't until he moved to Texas that we actually realized that. So it's a small world. Hope you're staying safe out there. Hope you're doing good. Hope you enjoy this interview with Brent. It's a ton of fun hearing about his first event. And you're listening to the All Day Rock Off podcast, episode number 153. Thank you so much for the support. Thank you so much for downloading this episode. Really hope you enjoy this interview with Brent Cooper. Had a ton of fun talking with him, learning about his first event, hearing how he didn't think that he would ever ruck again after the military. It's a good one. Here is the interview with Brent. Today, I'm talking with Brent Cooper, Executive Director for the Green Beret Foundation. Really, really excited to have him on. Brent, how you doing today?
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me on, man. I'm doing well. It's a nice day in San Antonio, Texas.
Glad to hear it. How long have you been in Texas for?
Been down here a year now. I took the job actually almost exactly a year. Yeah, I moved down here last May of 2019.
You know, it's funny because I feel like we've lived very similar lives, at least in location, because you were just outside the Seattle area for a number of years at the same time I was. I think we even lived within a couple miles of each other, 2 miles. You moved north, I moved north to, I think, within still a couple miles of each other. Then I moved east 4 miles, and you moved to Texas.
Yeah. When we were talking about that, and I was even telling my wife after I talked to you, I said, you know, I'm going to talk to Brian on this podcast. And believe it or not, we both lived just within a few miles of each other in Seattle for the 4 years that we were there. And I never knew it. Right. Just kind of goes to show how small this world is. You know, we probably crossed paths without even knowing it several times.
Yeah, I'm sure we did. I mean, based on the number of years that we both lived in the exact same area, it'd almost be harder not to have crossed paths at least once. So moving out of the Seattle, Washington area to Texas, did you do that for the executive director position at the Green Beret Foundation?
Yeah, specifically for the position. Got out of the military in 2015, moved up to Seattle for 4 years. And then when this position became available, put my name in the hat, and just pushed all my chips in, man. I talked to my wife about it, and I said, hey, interested in Texas at all? And, you know, she was like, hey, if it makes you happy and this seems like the right move, absolutely. So ended up getting selected to be the executive director, and we moved down here a year ago and been absolutely loving it. We love San Antonio, very family-friendly city, love Texas. So couldn't be happier, man.
So glad to hear it. And did the move work out well for the whole family?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a 4-year-old, so she loves it. Obviously, with COVID-19, not being able to get out of the house much now, getting a little stir crazy. But, you know, we probably give her too much screen time, as most parents are giving their kids right now. But it's all good.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents are in the same boat as you there. I mean, at the beginning of this, we were trying to do a bunch of schooling, but at this point, it's 2 kids go to bed at night, 2 kids wake up in the morning, we're good.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, I think when this all started, it was this very routine plan. Hey, let's do this all day. We got craft time, we got coloring time. And now it's just, I look at my kid, I'm like, she's still alive. She's good to go. My wife, Shelly, like she's kind of started to feel bad because she's like, hey, you know, I'm not teaching her letters and numbers, or, you know, she doesn't want to learn them that much and she's getting behind. And I'm just like, Shelly, stop. Like, I promise you, she's 4 years old. She will be just fine. you know, it's okay if she doesn't know all of her numbers right now.
I mean, we're trying to teach our kids, but we're also not trying to ruin our relationships with our kids, which I think is the most important part. Like I said at the start of all this, we're trying to do a bunch of the homework assignments, all that. My son Mason's 6 years old, but it's kind of just morphed into more learning through play. I think that that's been better for us, at least our relationship, and hopefully it works out for him too. So, I mean, speaking of COVID-19, you used to live up in this area. Was it weird seeing Kirkland in the news related to all this, since that's kind of where this whole thing started within the United States?
Well, I had an office very close to there, but I have a good friend of mine. He works at Overlake Hospital over in Bellevue, and he's been just telling me crazy stories when it's all started, you know, just how their hospital's max capacity. And, you know, they even had, they had this contingency plan, right? He's like, we did have pandemic plans and worst case scenario plans, and this far exceeded anything they could have imagined. So it's just interesting to hear it firsthand from somebody on the inside.
Man, well, I hope he's doing well.
Yeah, he's doing good.
Glad to hear it. So did you first meet Jason McCarthy through your interview process?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. When I got out in 2015, I remember I got out and I literally remember I told my wife, I said, I am never putting on a ruck again. Literally. Like, I don't want to carry heavy weight. I'll go jogging. You know, I got into training for some triathlons for a little while, but never wanted to put a pack on again. And it wasn't until I interviewed for the Green Beret Foundation and met Jason through the interview process. We talked extensively through Skype. And I had heard about Go Ruck, you know, kind of just through the grapevine, but didn't know much about it. And then obviously once I started interviewing, I started doing a ton of research on Go Ruck, everything that they're doing, everything about Jason. And I was like, holy shit, man, this is a really cool company. But then it also kind of surprised me because in my head, I'm thinking, why would people willingly want to just carry heavy stuff around, right? Carry heavy rucks around, just coming from the military and just how miserable it can be, right? Just exhausting. But that was my first encounter with Jason is during the interview process. And during the interview process, before I was even chosen, Jason, you know, in some follow-up email said, hey, not sure how it's all going to play out, but, you know, you got my vote, but I'm just one vote of many on the board of directors. Whether or not you become the ED or not, I'd love to have you as a cadre. So, you know, that was my first encounter with Jason, to answer your question.
That's funny. So you got out of the military, you said you're never putting on a ruck again. And then you start talking to Jason. And I mean, he wants you to be a cadre. One of the requirements to become a cadre is to do an event. So have you done a Go Ruck Tough event yet?
Yeah, I ended up doing an event. You know, I think the reason I kind of wanted to get back into it was once I started doing more research on Go Ruck, and it wasn't about, hey, let's just carry heavy weight for long periods of time and carry other heavy stuff on ourselves. It was about that team mentality, the building community, which is what I can get behind, right? And I thought, how cool would it be now to be, you know, cadre and get to be able to push people to the limit, push people past mental barriers that I've had the opportunity to push back and see the perspective that I have on certain aspects of life now. Like, I wanted to be able to have that. But yeah, so Jason said, hey, to be cadre, you have to participate in a tough event. And then you have to shadow, you know, a light and another tough. And really, you just end up actually leading the tough event. So kind of timeline-wise, this all happened last year. And I was scheduled to actually do a tough in Seattle. I think it was in June, like the beginning of June. And what ended up happening was I did get selected to be the executive director. And I had to move down to San Antonio right before the June event in Seattle. So I had to cancel the June event, move down to San Antonio, and ended up doing the San Antonio Tough. I think it was around June 15th last year, which I got to tell you, Brian, I wasn't thrilled about. I would have much preferred to do the Tough in Seattle based on the weather, obviously. Because now I moved down to San Antonio, have to do the tough event. You know, it's 95 degrees at, you know, midnight and 90% humidity, and it was pretty miserable.
Man, that sounds rough. I mean, one of the nice things about the Seattle area events, right, is that even when it's really tough, you can still look at the mountains, you can look at the water, look at the city. We've got so many good views out here. The weather's not terrible. You know, it rains a bit, mists a lot. When you're out there and it's sucking, it can be nice to have that mist on. It's, you know, cool and refreshing.
Yeah, and that's why I was kind of looking forward to the Seattle Tough. You know, plus I was familiar with the area. I thought it'd be cool to walk all over the city, obviously, you know, in the middle of the night, early morning hours. But end up coming down to San Antonio and did the Tough event.
I'd love to hear about that first event you did and, you know, especially the training you did up to it. Did you train specifically for the event? I know you'd been doing some triathlon stuff, but did you also train for the Gorik event?
Yeah, you know, after getting out of the military, I started working out pretty hard, because then it was like, hey, now I got to work out on my time when I want. Started working out really hard, got in really good shape. Then started grad school, had very little time to work out. Then had a child, had even less time to work out. And pretty much for 2 years of grad school, you know, didn't work out very much, because then it was just about working full time, going to school full time, and then being a dad full time. And the thing I had to sacrifice was working out, at least for me at that time. So kind of got in this rut of, you know, kind of feeling bad about myself and don't feel good. So, hey, I just really needed to start getting back in shape. And I'd always wanted to do a triathlon, always thought it was cool. So I started training to do triathlons. You know, just, hey, this would be amazing to do. Started getting back in shape, feeling good. Found out quickly that I actually really sucked at swimming. let me retract that statement a little bit. I'm really good at swimming. Like, just, hey, throw me in the pool, I'm good to go, I'm not going to drown. But actually getting on top of the water and, you know, I couldn't get the breathing down. Just something about it, man. It's a good thing I wasn't a Navy SEAL. We'll put it that way. And so I'm like, hey, maybe I'll just stick to duathlons instead, you know, just run, bike, run, you know, just running and biking. But so I started doing triathlons, and then that was, you know, just how I was staying in shape. But for me, it also was to always have a goal. You know, if I could schedule for an event, that's my goal. Then plan backwards how to train to get to that goal. It was always how I just kind of maintained my fitness. But to get to your point, I wasn't in crazy shape. I wasn't in, if this is a term, go ruck shape, you know, to put heavy weight on my back, because that's a whole different ballgame. So when I moved down to San Antonio and I knew I had the ruck coming up, I actually didn't train at all. I had been running a little bit. I hadn't done triathlons in probably over a year. You know, I was in decent shape. And I remember, because then I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, 30 pounds. Oh, that's no big deal, right? I'm used to carrying 100-pound rucks for miles on end, just bone crushing. So I'm thinking 30 pounds, no big deal. I'm not going to lie, man. I got my Go Ruck plate that came in the mail, the 30 pounds. I put 30 pounds on my back, and I was like, holy shit, this is heavy. You know, like, I hadn't put any weight on my back in so long. And just that 30 pounds felt so heavy. So let me kind of fast forward. So yeah, I hadn't really trained at all. I thought to myself, hey, it's a timed event. You know, it's going to start late at night and end in the morning. So I knew there's an ending point. Hey, I got the mindset, I'll just will myself through it. That was a huge mistake, to think I could just will myself through this thing in hindsight. Show up and everyone's kind of gathering around. And I could tell that a lot of people knew each other. They had been doing this before. I was kind of nervous. They didn't look nervous at all. And started introducing myself. They introduced themselves to me. And, you know, I'm just new to the area. And turns out I didn't even know this at the time. They were part of Hill Country Ruck Club here in the San Antonio area. and fantastic group of people, man. So there's about, I think there's about 20, 25 of us doing that tough.
Man, that's awesome. It's always great when you show up to an event and, you know, there's a rec club there, there's a group of people and they know what's going on. It can definitely be helpful. I'm curious with your training, you know, leading up to this, if there was a time during the event when you're thinking, man, you know, this is getting real. This is tough.
It was interesting because, so we started out and obviously the cadre leading the event, I had already connected with him. So he knew, you know, I was training to be a cadre. Essentially, I had to do this tough, but it started quickly when, you know, we're in the city of San Antonio, like deep in the, right in the city center. And we go and get the sandbags, connect them all together. And now, you know, we're already carrying sandbags linked together, carrying the rucks. It's already pretty miserable. We're a mile in. I'm already drenched in sweat. And that 30 pounds on your back, right? Throw in sticky chewies, some water. That becomes 40 pounds really quick. Throw on the sandbag. That becomes 100 pounds very quickly. So this 30 pounds that I'm thinking, oh, no big deal. No. It gets heavy quickly. And it was probably a couple miles in. And one of the people on our team, she went down. I don't know what happened, but we immediately, paramedics came and she wasn't able to continue. And so that was already kind of, you know, the team, they were really close. So it almost kind of bonded us closer together quickly. But the cadre made the right call, you know, and it was very apparent what I love too. It was, hey, safety first. We weren't going to mess around. But we kept trucking along after that, and it literally was probably about 2 hours in until we did, maybe just about 2 hours in, and then we got to this park, and that's where we had our welcome party. And I'm already kind of gasped, and we get in a circle, and everyone, you know, we start doing a lot of fun games, right? And I start getting extremely lightheaded to the point of like, man, I haven't felt like this in a long time, even in the military, like some of the training, I don't remember getting this lightheaded and I got to go lay down. And I immediately just lay myself down on my back. Some of the team members came over and in my head, right, I'm thinking, holy shit, man, I'm 2 hours into this tough event. You know, I'm the ED of the Green Beret Foundation, a former Green Beret. I can't go down. Like, I can't go down 2 hours into this event. And I laid my head back. I'll tell you, man, that team at Hill Country Ruck Club, some of the gals came over, immediately got me water, some beef jerky or something. And just laying on my back for about 3 minutes is like all it took. I don't know what it was, but if I hadn't laid down, man, I probably would have had the ambulance come pick me up too. I think it was just, you know, the PT, the weight, the exertion of energy I wasn't used to, you know, heat, humidity. But yeah, man, got back up, carried on. And it was a pretty miserable night though. But as far as just carrying heavy stuff, and I think it was hard for me too, because I didn't know where I was and I don't necessarily like that. I know people go all over the country and do these events and that's probably part of the cool part about it. But not knowing where I was and feeling like, how far away are we getting from our start point? Because I know the further we get away from our start point, we have to turn around and go back. So it wasn't like we're infilling in one location and get an exfil at another location. So every step we took further away from our start point was just one more mental hurdle to get over. Because you're like, every step away is steps I got to take back again.
And that's one of the things too, right? Is a lot of these people who do multiple events, who travel for events, the event that they travel for isn't their first event. So it's not like they're brand new city they've never been to and a brand new experience. I mean, all GORC events are unique in their own way, thanks to the cadre that come and do them. But having it both be your first event, you don't exactly know what to expect at all. And a new city where you don't know where you are, or where you're going. I mean, that's gotta be tough. But I mean, it sounds like you had a great team there and, you know, you had to lay down for 3 minutes, get some food, get some water, and your team was there to support you. And, you know, I've got not really an endurance sport background for many years, but you know, I've been doing events for the past 9 years, and there aren't many events where something like that will happen, where you know someone will go down and everyone will kind of flock around, make sure they're good. Triathlons, races, you know, that kind of stuff, people go down and everyone's still trying to beat their best time. So I think that's one of the things that makes GoWork events and the community behind them really, really unique.
Oh yeah. And that's why immediately I'm like, they got it right. They as in like GoWork, you know, it's all about the team. It's all about the person to your left and to your right. You know, I use this term a lot frequently is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And really you have to have that mentality on these events, because it serves no purpose for an individual in an event like this to just go fast, right? Like, if you're not working as a team together, you're screwed, you know, and you figure it out pretty quickly. The more you work as a team together, the better off everybody's going to be. You're sharing the burden, you're sharing the weights appropriately. You learn quickly how to pass it off. You know, some guys carry more than others, but in the end, you kind of balance it out. You know, you got water jugs to carry, ammo crates, sandbags, just all sorts of random stuff, you know, if the cadre chooses to have you carry it. And we carried a lot of stuff. But what I really liked about it is, you know, it's a civilian event, but there was so much of the military aspect, of the special forces aspect and soft community brought into this, as far as relying on the person to your left and right, your movements, as far as, hey, we're going to pick up and go from this location to the next location. It's a couple miles away. You know, we have to get there in X amount of time. And then when you get to that location, kind of rest for a little bit, refit, play some more games. But I like that mentality of, it wasn't just about crushing people, you know, it was about, yeah, we're going to push barriers within you, not just physically, but mentally, from point to point throughout the night. And I love that. I think everybody in this community loves that. You know, they love pushing themselves to the limit. They love that physical and mental challenge that events like this provide them. You know, the other thing too, I know there's a lot of cadre. I haven't met all the guys. And actually, I should say, I'm not cadre yet. Like, I literally, after that event, I haven't found the time to be able to do another tough and light back-to-back, but I also haven't carved out the time. You know, I've been just, the position, just been working a ton. And so it's hard to carve out, you know, a weekend to do this again. But, you know, the cadre we had, J-Dub was our cadre. Awesome guy. And I really, what was cool too, is talking to the teammates, they were able to kind of give me, or they would say, hey, we've done so many events and it's really cool actually that all the cadre are different. They have different styles. They have different ways they lead. They have, you know, some may be a little bit more aggressive, some a little less aggressive as far as whether it's verbal or just making you do stuff. And so the team was like, they kind of like that, but then they kind of gravitate to, hey, once they find cadre that really mesh with them, they kind of, they'll also follow those cadre's events as well. And so for me, it started making me think, you know, what type of cadre would I be? And I think for me, stylistically, my personality, you know, I've been a soccer coach for many years earlier on in my life, played soccer my whole life. I also coach. I always loved being a coach. And I was never an extremely verbal person, as far as, I didn't ever feel like I have to yell at people to motivate them. And I think for me, it's because I say this a lot, people self-assess themselves. And I think you don't have to yell at somebody to either break them or motivate them, in my opinion. I think there's ways that you can get people to question themselves. You know, hey, you know, I can tell you, I don't think you're going to make it, man. I really don't. Do you? Do you think you can make it? Because I don't. You know, I could say that to you and you're going to immediately start thinking in your head, wow, can I really make it? He doesn't think I'm going to make it. So the point there is, You know, are you going to allow somebody else to tell you what you can and cannot do? And I found that out quickly. Let me kind of backtrack. When I joined the military, I'd signed an 18 X-ray contract, which means guaranteed slots, not guaranteed outcomes, in order to try and become a Green Beret. And I remember in basic training, there was about 130 of us that signed an X-ray, 18 X-ray contract. To this day, I believe only about 9 of us became Green Berets. But out of 130 guys, I remember we'd go out on the parade field, we'd sit on this hill, and they would bring a Green Beret in. And I remember they would bring a Green Beret in, and it was the first time any of us like really saw a Green Beret in real life. You know, he has his uniform on, his awesome Green Beret on, and we're just thinking we're seeing God here, right? Because it's like, hey, all of us signed this contract and aspire to be this person that's right in front of us now. So imagine 130 guys on the parade field on the lower end of this hill. Green Beret comes in. He's standing there on the hill looking down on us, arms crossed, and just scanning left to right, looking at all of us. Points to people, random people that he's never met in his life. He just points to people and says, "You're not going to make it." Scans his head again. "You're sure as shit not going to make it." And he just starts telling people they're not going to make it. And guess what happened? After he left, there was probably 5, 6, 7 guys that went to the drill sergeants and essentially dropped their contracts. This is not a lie. These guys back in basic training gave up on their dream because some Green Beret walked in, pointed to them, and said, "You're sure as shit not going to make it. I can tell you're not going to make it. You're out of shape," having no idea who they are, right? And it just baffled my brain, like baffled my mind, man. Just absolutely baffled me that you would allow somebody to tell you what you can and cannot do. And I think for me, that inspired me, actually. And I think that's why I say people self-assess themselves, because I've seen it firsthand. I saw it firsthand. I've seen it so many times where they're just going to believe they can't do something. And it's a crazy thought to me. It's a crazy mentality. I went down that rabbit hole.
That's a good one, because I mean, it's so true, because you might have this lingering thought in the back of your mind, right? You're like, man, can I really do this? And all you need is that one person to make that negative push and say, you know, without you even saying anything, say, "Dude, there's no way that you're going to become a Green Beret. There's no way you're going to finish this event," you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it just tell somebody, "Yeah, you're not going to finish it." And then it reaffirms what your self-doubt and fears were already thinking. But that's the crazy part about it. You're allowing that affirmation from somebody that doesn't really even know you at all to creep in, and you let that self-doubt, you know, just kind of fester all within you, and then it mentally breaks you. Our minds are actually very weak, I've learned, you know, through training, going through the Army, Special Forces. You learn quickly that our bodies are actually extremely resilient. It's our minds that are extremely weak. And, you know, when you're working out, when you're doing something hard and you feel like, "I can't go on, I need to quit right now," that's your mind telling you to quit. Yeah, your body might be aching, your back might be breaking from the ruck, the heavy weight on your, you know, your legs or your quads are burning. But I'll tell you, man, it's your mind that's telling you to quit. You can kind of keep pushing past that barrier. And before you know it, you just went 2 more miles, 3 more miles, 5 more miles. And you're like, "Holy shit." You know, I thought 5 miles ago, I couldn't take one more step. And now here I am. And you've probably experienced that yourself, right? In all the events you've done.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things about those events, and one of the reasons why it's so fun to do more than one of them, is that it just reaffirms it every time. I mean, if you go out there and you show up right to the start of the event, and before the event, the cadre gives you a laundry list of every single thing that you're going to be doing with every single piece of weight you're going to be moving. I mean, the thing's going to be huge, and it's going to be so overwhelming, and I'm sure people would potentially self-assess right there. But you know, when you're
when you're actually getting through it and you're in the moment and you're thinking, you know, like there's no way, but you keep going and the team keeps going. I mean, you realize, you know, there is a way. It's just your brain telling yourself there's no way, and your brain's got to take a back seat for a second.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why these events are so cool. And you know, cool is an understatement, but it's because it's not just about, hey, let's see how much weight we can carry for how many hours on end. It's pushing your brain past these mental barriers and putting you in a position to overcome these mental hurdles or challenges or roadblocks that you put up in your head, thinking that you can't do something. And these type of events force you to kind of break down those walls, overcome those hurdles, and you now, you know, it changes your perspective because you're thinking, holy shit, I did not think I was going to be able to achieve that. I did not think I was going to be able to finish that. And I did. And not only did I finish it, I crushed it. And I think when you start being able to overcome hurdles like that, challenges like that, it builds your confidence in other areas of your life as well. Because then you think, hey, you know, if I can overcome that, I can overcome all these other obstacles that I think I had barriers on as well. Maybe not getting that job or the position or not being able to ask that girl or guy out. You know, I'm just random examples. But it kind of gives you more courage, more confidence, and just ability, I think, to just conquer the world around you, man. Like I tell my wife all the time, she thinks I'm crazy, but I literally believe there is nothing in this world I could not achieve. Now, that said, right, I have that mentality, that perspective of like literally anything I want to put my mind to, I could go do it. It may require years of training. It may require years of schooling or whatever. But if you set that goal, plan backwards, there's nothing that should be able to get in your way. Now, everything I say except probably swimming. So I'll just leave that. I got to be able to swim, man. But I feel very strongly about that. And so that's why I love these Go Ruck events, being able to push people past those mental barriers and hurdles, and then the team camaraderie around it as well. Because even just that one event I did, I already feel bonded to all those people, right? Like we're connected on social media. And yeah, we're not able to hang out all the time based on just how much I work and stuff, but we still stay connected on social media. And for me, it's, hey, we went through the suck together. And when we go through the suck together, we're immediately bonded for life. Like that's how I view it. So anything they need at any time and vice versa, I know I could just text them or call them or email them and, hey, let's make it happen. I don't know. For me, it's that simple for me.
So when you showed up to this event, or even before that, when Jason had been telling you about this event and said, hey, you should come out, do this, you can become a cadre, did you think that you would finish the event and leave it feeling this way?
No, that's a great question. I answered that quickly because I didn't really have to think about it. First, what's funny is I didn't understand. I spent the majority of my life as a civilian, but I still couldn't understand why civilians would want to ruck willingly. Okay. Because it wasn't something I'd ever done before the military. And when I got out of the military, I didn't know that this whole rucking community even existed. Right. I had no idea this rucking community existed. So when I kind of got pushed into it and started reading up on it more and learning more about it, I was baffled. I was like, man, I didn't know people actually liked to put rucks on their back and do this for fun. Because for me, the only time I did was in the military, and it wasn't that it was just forced on you, but, you know, you kind of had to do it, right? And so now as a civilian, it's like, well, I have a choice whether or not I want to endure this type of suck or not. I'd rather just go put on some running shorts and some tennis shoes and just go for a 10-mile run, nice and cushy with my earpods in. First, I was figuring out just an understanding that why people would want to do this. Going into it, I thought, hey, we're just all going to come together, carry heavy shit for a long period of time, get in our cars and go home. I truly didn't understand the gravity of the camaraderie that it was going to build along the way, because there was a lot more involved, you know, with our movements from point to point. Every time we'd get to a point, you know, it would be, and at the time this was, I believe it was, we were honoring the Battle of Mogadishu. And so we were honoring the service members, you know, that were killed during that time. And so it was also a very emotional event as well. And people came well prepared. You know, everybody had their laminated cards of service members that they wanted to honor. We would talk about them, you know, and so it made it this much more intimate event and really bonded us together and brought us together. And I absolutely underestimated that aspect of this event. And so by the end of the event, you know, yeah, we're giving high fives and hugs and earning our patches. But the friendships, I think, the lifelong friendships I built just from one event, I did not anticipate that whatsoever.
That's really cool. And it's one of those things that I think surprises a lot of people after their first event too, kind of just how grouped together everyone gets during it and how, you know, how much of a team people really become.
Yeah, super cool. But I'll tell you, I still think some of those people are crazy because I was like, how many events have you done? You know, in my head, I'm thinking, you know, you do like 6 or 7 of these, you're pretty crazy. And they're like, oh, like 50. I got, you know, they're showing me their patches on their boards and from their pictures. And I'm thinking, you've done like 40, 50 events. Oh yeah, no problem. And that blew my mind. That blew my mind. But again, it was just me not understanding this community whatsoever. And when you really look at it, this is no different than anybody else, you know, whether you're doing CrossFit or triathlons, or you're just an avid runner or cyclist. Like, everybody's got their thing that they love to do and work out. And so rucking is no different, you know, and it's not, you know, obviously it's something a little bit newer probably to the, workout world, or what would you say?
The athletic space, maybe.
The athletic space. Thank you. Yeah. The athletic space, right? I mean, think about when CrossFit came on the scene, you know, it wasn't that well known. And then as it kind of started catching on, you know, now it's blown up. You know, I kind of see the same thing for rucking, because I absolutely see, and CrossFit too, it's not just about the movements and what you're doing, it's about the community aspect of it. And so I kind of look at rucking as being somewhat similar in, hey, it's kind of it's new to the athletic space for the most part for civilians, but it also has that community building aspect to it. So it's much more than just, hey, I could go throw on my running shoes and go run 10 miles and I'm going to get fit and it's going to feel good, but I'm alone, right? I'm alone, feels good, and I'm building my endurance, but it lacks any real mental hurdles, any real physical barriers. It lacks any community building, camaraderie, teamwork. Like, those are things that can't be replicated unless you are doing something like this, you know, as far as rucking or a go-ruck event. That's kind of the way I look at it, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've rucked with a lot of people and I've run with a lot of people. And when you're running with people, you know, usually get grouped off into pace groups, because if someone's running a 6-minute mile, they don't want to run with people who are running an 8-minute mile, who don't want to run with people who are running 12 or 14. And you know, you've got these groups, and then you go out there and everyone's usually, you know, pushing pretty hard and no one's, you know, talking to each other a little bit, but it's not like rucking with a group where, you know, everyone's together. You're going at your pace and you increase or decrease the amount of weight depending on how much of a workout you need. So you could have someone out there with a sandbag and a 30-pound plate, and you could have someone out there who's just getting started with a 10 or a 20-pound plate, and you know, they'll be going at the same pace. They can talk to each other, get to know each other, build community. Whereas if they're separated off into pace groups, you know, they probably wouldn't talk to each other until the end, if even then.
Exactly. And this forces you to be together the entire time. Like, you know, you have to be. And yeah, that, you know, 30 pounds, even 20 pounds. Yeah, you put it on your back and you're like, oh, this ain't that bad. carry it for a couple miles, that gets heavy quickly. Your shoulders are burning, your back's burning. Yeah, it brought back a lot of memories quickly from my time in the military, and just the burn on your shoulders that pack feels on you.
Yeah, it's a feeling.
You know how good it's going to feel once you complete it and then you get to take it off. Like, that is a great feeling.
It is. You feel like you're just floating away.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you moved down to Texas. You did your first GORC event. You took this brand new position for you, the executive director for the Green Beret Foundation. You know, how's that been going for you?
It's been going great, man. Over the last year, we made a lot of changes as far as, you know, we got a new website up, kind of tweak some of our programs. You know, I've really tried to get out and meet as many guys as I can at the groups, talk to guys. Really, just a big piece that I saw was just letting our community, because we help specifically Green Berets and their families. So that's our charter. And just being able to communicate what it is we do and the support that we provide. So people know who to call. People know who to, you know, get on the website, request support, or pick up the phone, and who to call when they need something. So for me, you know, going back into the nonprofit space, it was an area that was near and dear to my heart. I'm passionate about serving something greater than myself, and this was a way for me to kind of serve again in this capacity, being able to, you know, running a nonprofit, but then serving the person to my left and right, serving the guy to my left and right, but making sure they have what they need.
That's awesome. Yeah. So you've been, I mean, just, it sounds like diving right into this new position. I mean, it sounds like you're, you know, you're working quite a bit. You're putting the hours in. Who could have thought that, what, three quarters of the way into this, you know, COVID-19 would hit? Has that put, you know, any hurdles in your way, or has that changed things up and kind of how you expected they'd be going for your first year on the job?
Yeah, COVID-19 hitting, it's been pretty shitty for everybody. I'll be honest with you, like across the globe. But for us at the foundation, I would say, you know, yeah, putting in the hours, but at the same time, I don't believe, well, let me say, I don't believe like work-life balance thing. I think for me, it's always been a work-life integration. That's just how I function best. And so for a nonprofit, it's not banker hours. We're not 9 to 5, hey, Monday through Friday. We're at the needs of our community. And so for me, my phone's always on me. I tell people, text me, email me. Literally, if I don't respond within 5-10 minutes, it's because I'm asleep or I'm dead. Doesn't matter what time of day. But with that, right, I'm just kind of always on. And as far as when COVID-19 hit, things haven't changed that much as far as the support we're providing, but it has changed on the aspect of how we're raising money. Because, you know, as a 501c3 nonprofit, we rely on, you know, grants, individual giving. And so those contributions are how we provide support to our community. And so right now, with the focus being on, you know, first responders, you know, we've actually tried to shift our approach as well on, hey, you know, our Green Berets that are still on the front lines, you know, they're still in wars all over the globe. Their families are at home and people are losing jobs. People still need help. And so we've developed an emergency relief fund where people can still give. And those dollars are going specifically to people in need right now that are experiencing the repercussions that COVID-19 has, you know, unemployment, people struggling to make ends meet. So we've been able to still assist in that area, which is fantastic. The good part is, you know, we've been able to work from home, you know, as long as we've got internet, as long as we got Wi-Fi and a computer and a phone, we're good to go. So with the team, we still get on calls. We still get on Zoom calls. We still check in, and we're still able to work and do exactly what we need to do to continue our mission.
I'm glad to hear it. And it's crazy with technology these days. I mean, just how much you can get done remote. But I mean, that's got to be tough kind of, you know, some of the calls you're probably getting, because this is, you know, a really stressful time for everyone and for the people you work with. some of them are deployed, some of them still, you know, their families are still home and they're going through all of this and they're not around. It's got to be a tough situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it is tough. But I'll tell you, you know, the team we have at the Green Beret Foundation is phenomenal. They extremely passionate individuals. You know, I can say this with certainty, and probably a lot of other people in the nonprofit space will say this, say the same thing. If you don't have passion for your mission in a nonprofit organization, you're not going to be very successful because, like I said, there's no, we don't have regular hours. We're at the needs of our mission, and the mission comes first, no matter what. And I don't know if that sounds maybe a little too harsh, right? Mission first, but you have to maintain that mentality where there's no single person or no individual that is greater than the mission. And so, you know, what I'm trying to develop is extreme continuity at the Green Beret Foundation to where, hey, this foundation has to sustain for years to come for the needs of our regiment. And so when you keep that as the focal point, that's our mission, to make sure that the regiment, the Special Forces community, has the necessary resources they need now and long into the future. Like, that's my objective, right? That's my objective, plan backwards and do everything it takes in order to achieve that.
And that's one of the unique things behind a nonprofit is that, you know, when you establish it, it becomes its own entity and it doesn't live or die with the person who started it like a small business does. You know, when someone's done working and they retire, then the small business closes. But, you know, when someone's done working at a nonprofit, that thing still exists and it's got to be built in a way that it keeps going and the next person can take over and the next. And, you know, there's a lot to think about with that. They're really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming from the for-profit world, you know, most of my time was spent in the for-profit world, but I remember when I was being interviewed for the position and I said, look, for-profit, nonprofit, if you're not growing, you're dying. It's still business. You know, a nonprofit is still a business. The reality is the main difference is a lot of the reporting structure you have to the IRS. But aside from that, it's still a business you're trying to grow. Yes, the objective is not to make profits. The objective is to make sure as much money that comes in is going out, fulfilling your mission, going back to the community. And that's the objective. And for me, it's almost that simple. Like, there, it's very nuanced, everything in between. But the objective is provide as much support to the Special Forces community as possible. That's the objective. So then it makes every single decision in order to get to that objective relatively easy when, you know, it almost becomes that binary, because every decision is, you know, I got this written on the whiteboard at the office. The way the foundation, really my two visions, it's really simple. Every decision is based on two things. One, does this service our soldier or his family? Two, will this make our donors proud? When every decision is based on answering those two questions, it makes every decision relatively simple. Does this service our soldier? Will this make our donors proud? Because as a nonprofit, I've got a fiduciary responsibility to ensure that every dollar coming in is maximized to go back out to our community. So for me, it's like I said, it's a simple objective, a little bit nuanced in between how to get there, but it makes pretty much the decision making on a day-to-day basis relatively simple.
I like that. And I mean, those are important things that you're asking every decision you make, but just having that written down somewhere so you can, you know, even if you're struggling with something, you just glance over, look at it. It's just a solid reminder, right, of what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in terms of the programs that the GBF has going on right now, you know, are there some that you're really excited about? What's a program right now that you're just kind of stoked on?
That's like asking me if I have a favorite child. I love all of our programs. You know, we've got a great casualty support program, great extended support program where we're providing alternative therapies. We're doing Gold Star and surviving family support, transition support. So we really cover the full gamut of everything that our community needs. And that's what really makes the Green Beret Foundation a little bit different than other organizations out there is because we really create a customized approach to supporting the soldier and what they need. You know, there are things, even though we cover a full array, there's some stuff that we can't provide the support in-house. So I'm really big on collaborating with other organizations out there that might do that might be able to provide support that we can't. And so really what I'm saying is if anybody comes to us, it's never, no, I can't help you. It's, hey, that might be out of a wheelhouse. And so I can get you in touch with this person over here and get you the help you need. You know, as an example, substance abuse. You know, I don't have anybody in house that's going to be able to help somebody through substance abuse, but I'm going to link you up with a program or an individual that's going to be able to get you the help you need. And then, you know, we're going to help cover on the back end, maybe some of the finances involved while you're getting the help you need through this program. We'll take care of some of your bills on the back end, kind of as an example.
You know, and that's just so important because you know what you're good at and you know where your expertise lies. You know the programs that you might not have, but other people have very good programs for. And so you can kind of refer them over. My wife's on the board for a nonprofit in our local area up in Everett. And it's a lot of the same. They have, you know, really good connections to other nonprofits in the area. And if someone comes with an issue, even if it's not in their wheelhouse, you know, their first thought isn't, well, let's build a brand new wheelhouse so that we can help this person. It's, well, that person across the street has a, you know, exactly what you need. Let's make the connections. Let's lower the barriers for you to get over there and deal with it that way. I think it's really cool to see the collaboration between nonprofits occurring in the space.
Yeah, it has to be that way. I believe there's over 50,000 veteran nonprofit organizations out there. You know, and they stem from very small organizations to the large organizations, but that is a lot. So when you look at, if you look at it as a very competitive landscape, if you look at it as, hey, I'm just trying to beat everybody and be number one, I don't think that's the right approach, particularly in the nonprofit space, because it's not about you. It's about the people you're providing support to. And so the way we win, it's not about being number one or who's making the most money. The way we win is how are we going to collaborate together to provide the best support possible to everybody we're trying to provide support to, which is you, which is me, which is my neighbor, which is everybody, right? Everybody needs help at one point in their lives. And so the more we collaborate, the better efforts we're going to be able to combine in order to provide the support that we need to provide. That's the way I look at it.
I just say that's such a, you know, such a great way to look at it too. It's like you said, it's a nonprofit space. There's a lot out there. And so there's a lot of people doing good work. And man, I'm excited to hear your attitude on that because it's something that I've got the same attitude. I'm really excited about.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, again, I'm not sure. It's just my perspective, the way I see it. And sometimes I see it too simplistically. But, you know, there's always in the nonprofit space, it's, hey, you know, everybody's fighting over donor dollars and we need to make sure people are still giving money. And it's, you know, there's a lot of money out there. And I think as long as you're able to tell your story well, you know, and who you're providing support to, and you're getting your little piece of the pie there, right? It's not about just being number one. It's not about, you don't have to be Amazon or Microsoft or right, the absolute number one organization out there. You just have to make sure that you have enough resources to be able to provide everything you need to be able to provide to the people you're providing it to. So beyond that, yeah, fantastic if we grow larger. And the goal obviously is to grow larger to ensure that down the road we have the resources available as this community grows as well. Because we provide resources for active duty, separated, and retired. So it's not just the individuals that are in right now. It's, hey, no matter what. And there's no statute of limitations on our support either. So a Green Beret that retired years ago can still reach out to us and ask for support, which is fantastic.
Absolutely. I mean, got to feel nice, because, you know, it's not like someone will call up and say, oh, well, you actually retired, you know, 11 years ago, and we kind of run out at 10 years, so can't help, right? It's, you know, oh, you're a Green Beret? Yeah, we've got you.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm curious right now, because COVID-19 has been pretty crazy, and I know it's been just different for nonprofits. You kind of alluded to that. You know, how can people support during this current time? What can people do to help out?
Well, to answer your question, as a nonprofit, the best way people can help out is by giving. And that's sometimes hard to do, because there's so many organizations out there. There's a lot of organizations that people like to give to. But as far as the Green Beret community, you know, our soldiers, Green Beret specifically, you know, 60% of all casualties since 9/11, Green Berets have suffered that across the entire, under the SOF umbrella, under the special operations umbrella. So for Green Berets, you know, it's kind of tough, because you mostly hear about Navy SEAL stories and what they're doing. You know, in Green Berets, we're trained not to talk about what we're doing. But I assure you that Green Berets are scattered all over the globe right now in very austere environments, doing very hush-hush things. You know, and so on the home front, you know, there's a lot of stresses there. There's a lot of stressors there and things going on, which is why we exist, which is why the foundation exists. So for people being able to help, you know, you can go on our website and you can donate. If you want to donate specifically to our emergency relief fund, you can do that aspect, or you can donate specifically to the emergency relief fund or just to our general fund. Because for me, I tell people, you know, like I said, what I like is that on average, 87 cents of every dollar goes back to our mission. And I'm very proud to say that, because that's a big thing for nonprofits, is looking at that programmatic expense. So 87 cents of every dollar is going directly back to the people that we support. 'Cause for me also, you know, when I give to an organization, you know, if I give $20 to this person or that person, I'm like, well, where's that $20 going? You know, and that's real talk. You know, I want to make sure that my $20 is going to the actual mission that this foundation is saying that they're providing the money to.
Yeah, that's an awesome number. And I think that's important. And I mean, personally, when I donate to organizations, I usually just donate into the general fund, because I figure if this is an organization I trust, which if I'm sending their money, then I trust them, then I trust that they'll know what to do with the money more so than I would as an, you know, an outsider looking in. I mean, that's just how I think, because, you know, who knows where the need will be. And it always, I've got this story. Well, I'm sure a lot of towns have this story, but, you know, town I was in growing up, some of the playgrounds were, you know, they could reuse a remodel, library could use a little bit of help, but the town got a grant for, I think it was around like $20,000, but it was very specific that it had to be spent on art pieces. Like there was a, like this very specific thing that they got. And so, you know, there was articles about it, and they were, you know, even the town was like, can't we just like spend this money on something else? Like, nope, the grant that you applied for, it's very specific. And so they end up, you know, buying these art pieces for the park. And so you've got this really nice art piece next to kind of this broken park. And they're like, man, like, why couldn't we have spent this money on the park? And it's, know, so it's like general fund. At least that's one of the stories I remember, because my parents were talking about it growing up. And then, you know, extrapolating it to real life now, whenever I see the different list of funds, I'm like, man, I don't know. I don't know where the need is for all this. So I'm going to throw it in general, and I trust the nonprofit to know where the need is and to spend it appropriately.
Yeah. And that's the right perspective to have. And that's why I brought up, you know, looking at that programmatic spend is kind of the important aspect of, you know, cause there's a lot of great organizations out there, you know, and as people that give, you know, you, me, everyone else listening, you know, given to charitable organizations, you want to make sure that those dollars are being used for the mission. And that's what's important. But I wanted to mention, Brian, you know, you've been a huge supporter of GBF as well over the years, you know, the events that you've done and being able to give back. I didn't know if you wanted to talk about that at all.
I mean, we can. I usually don't talk about myself, but we can absolutely talk about that. I mean, I started Charity Challenges with Kirk, and you know, we've been supporting the GBF through that for years and years and years. And you know, it's the GBF has had a very close relationship with GORUCK. I mean, that's how I originally found out about the Green Beret Foundation. I don't always like using the words back in the day, but back in the day, you know, there was a lot of GORUCK related products that people would make and actually sell on closed Facebook groups. Like there's all this off-brand GORUCK products. It's pretty funny, you know, existing out there from years and years ago, but they're sold as Green Beret Foundation fundraisers. So, you know, it's been an organization that I've always followed and always donated to. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited to have you on.
It's awesome to hear, man. Yeah, you've been a huge supporter. And for me, I think what I love, and probably you can kind of surmise this just based on our conversation, for me, it's more than just the dollars, right? That team mentality, supporting the mission, you know, that's bigger than any one of us. And that's why, you know, GORUCK is so big. That's why there's such a huge community around it, you know, because it's not just an endurance event. Anybody can just put an endurance event together. You know, that's not hard. That's not that challenging. But to create an endurance event where you're able to build, remember they used to have Build Better Americans, right? I don't know if they still use that tagline, do they?
As far as I know.
You know, building better Americans or building better people. You know, pushing them past barriers and challenges. But yeah, I just want to thank you for being a fantastic supporter, you know, and it's because of these events that you're putting on, you know, that are actually building better people because of it. It's about something bigger than yourself, you know, serving something bigger than yourself, whatever that means. You know, it means something different to everybody, but just doing something more selfless, you know, and that's something I always just try and aspire to do every day is, hey, you know, it's not all about me. How can I help somebody today?
Thank you so much for listening to the All Day Rock Off podcast. This has been episode number 153. You can get links to everything we talked about at the show notes, alldayrockoff.com/153. Brent, really, really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks again for taking the time. I just want you to know I appreciate it. Hopefully once you've shadowed a couple of those GORUCK events and you become a cadre, you can come back on. We can talk about some of that because it was really good connecting and I really enjoyed this call. Thanks again. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to help support the All Day Rock Off podcast, you can always leave a review either on Apple Podcasts or on Facebook. Just search for All Day Rock Off. If you want to support financially, there's an online store, alldayrockoff.com/store. And then, of course, there's Patreon, patreon.com/alldayrockoff, where there's additional bonus podcast episodes, videos, some other projects I'm working on, a lot of additional content there as well. So thank you so much for supporting in any of those ways, and even just for downloading this episode, because, of course, that's an awesome way to support it. So thank you. Again, I really hope you enjoyed this interview with Brent Cooper, Executive Director of the Green Beret Foundation. And I can't wait to talk to you again next week. As always, don't forget, attitude is everything. Keep yours positive. And thank you again for tuning in.